tuned in to the Andrew Lawton Show.
I want to welcome into the show Josh DeHaas, who is a lawyer with the Canadian Constitution Foundation, where he is also a preeminent podcast host, a competitor, but he does great work over there alongside Christine Van Gine and Joanna Baron. Josh, good to have you back on the show. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be here.
So I want to talk about this free speech fight in Prince Edward Island in a few moments, but just on the online harm stuff, obviously we have to wait for the text of the bill to come out, but we know from the first version of it and what the government has said in public messaging, what it's likely to look like here. This is going to be just a feeding frenzy for civil liberties lawyers, based on like any interpretation of what they're coming out with, right?
Yeah, well, if they come out with a bill that brings back something like Section 13, you know, if anything that looks like what they proposed under Bill C-36, they're going to have all kinds of challenges because, you know, it's just would not be constitutional to do something that extreme, to have, you know, $20,000 fines for things that you say on the internet that somebody finds offensive. And so we really hope that that's not what they come up with. But I guess we'll have to wait and see for the details. In terms of this idea of an ombudsman, or I think we're supposed to say ombudsperson. So
it's actually hate speech if you say ombudsman.
It could be under this new bill. So I'll just go with the ombudsperson to be careful here. That raises all kinds of other potential free speech issues here. You know, if they go with 24-hour takedowns, that is just going to lead Facebook and other, other internet service providers to take down anything that could put them at risk or make them liable. So that would be a huge free speech issue, too, that we would have to try and attack.
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer. I play one on TV sometimes, but the one thing that comes out here is that under C-18, the Liberal government put this regulation, this requirement on companies like Facebook and Google, and said you guys have to pay news companies if you're going to have news on your platform. So Facebook says, all right, it's not worth the hassle. We're just going to ban news. We looked into it. We got a legal opinion because we were wondering if we could sue the government. And every lawyer we talked to said, well, no. Because Facebook made the decision. I mean, they may have done it in response to legislation, but your issues with Facebook, which has, I would concede, no legal obligation to allow anyone to use its platform. You apply that here, and I worry that the same thing applies, where Facebook will just develop a broad terms of service to encompass the law. But if Facebook's zapping your content, where's your recourse if you've been censored? Do you even have any?
Yeah, that would be that's the issue here. So I think you could still mount some sort of challenge, but it would be very difficult to do if Facebook itself wasn't getting involved in that sort of charter challenge. The other concern I would have is that companies like Facebook might just leave Canada, and you know, people laugh at that, but right now you have similar sorts of legislation in the European Union, and they're telling Twitter all the time, look, if you don't comply with our requirements and get rid of more of what we consider misinformation, then we might kick Twitter out of Europe. And Canada is a lot smaller. Twitter probably cares a lot less about us. But there's a possibility that if Twitter is faced with some sort of legislation that says they have a duty of care to take down information that is so-called, you know, misinformation or discriminatory, that they might just pull out at some point.
Let me ask you about that arbitrator aspect here, because a lot's changed in the internet in the time that Section 13 was there originally. It was repealed in 2013 to now. Social media companies are much more powerful. We also have a government that I think has been much more emboldened on this idea of reining in online hate, whereas Section 13 was really created in response to fax machines, if you go back to the origin of it. So this idea of supercharging it by putting all these requirements on tech companies, I see as being quite problematic. But they also seem to think that they had kind of charter-proofed that the language with Bill C-36 by drawing from the Watcott decision. I was wondering if you could just give a brief primer on how that decision framed what free speech and hate speech in this context are.
Yeah, so Watcott attempted to say that there is, you know, a line over which you cannot cross between speech that's acceptable and speech that is hateful and can be constitutionally limited by the criminal laws. And, you know, what ends up happening when you try to draw those lines is you just end up using a lot of synonyms. So Walklot says, you know, basically, if your speech is inciting, you know, detestation against a group, that's illegal. But if you're just offending a group or being hurtful towards a group, that's not okay. So I don't know how any reasonable person can tell the difference between words like, you know, detestation or, you know, extreme dislike, which is another one that's apparently okay. And so all that Walcott really clarifies is that there is some line and it's really hard to know where that is. With criminal,
it's going to be like the old, I know it when I see it, interpretation on pornography, right?
Right, exactly. And if there's that much subjectivity involved, then you're really at the mercy of whoever the decision maker is. And let's say there's some, you know, digital safety czar or ombudsperson, as I guess they're now called, in the legislation. It's going to be up to, you know, their tastes and their view about what is hateful and what isn't. And that's where the problem comes in, because these are, you know, government appointees, and what they're offended by might be perfectly legitimate speech.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, people, when they have this debate, I mean, the big problem we run up against is that people have trouble separating their emotional valuation of a particular expression from whether it has merit as a legal form of expression. And again, we do not have a right to be comfortable. We do not have a right to not be offended or bothered or perturbed. Now I'm the one using all the synonyms. And I think this case in PEI is a great example of this. You have a counselor there in Murray Harbor, a very, very small community. I don't even think it's at town level. I think it's an even lower threshold than town. And my colleague, Lindsay Shepherd, wrote about John Robinson a while ago. He put up a sign on his own property. And the sign, we have a picture there, truth, mass grave hoax, reconciliation, redeem Sir John A's integrity. I think it's pretty clear what he's referring to on both counts. And you may drive by that and say, I agree, I disagree, doesn't really matter. He's now facing potential removal as a counselor over this. So explain what's going on here.
Yeah, so John put up this sign back in September, and this is a sign. It's one of those signs where you can, you know, change the plastic letters. I think you just showed it, that you see outside of, you know, churches or sometimes, you know, town halls. And he uses this just to spread his messages. Often it's things like, you know, happy or congratulations to the newlywed couple, or, you know, there's some festival coming up and he wants to advertise it. But occasionally he uses it for more political speech. And in this case, he put up this sign because he's angry about the idea that in 2021, everybody was sort of led to believe that these mass graves had been located at Indian residential schools, when in fact, what was most likely found were cemeteries with unmarked graves. Obviously very sad what happened at residential schools, but he's annoyed that this narrative sort of persists. So obviously this is his private speech on his private property, but his fellow village counselors didn't like this message. So they went after him using their code of conduct bylaw. And, you know, municipalities across Canada have these codes of conduct. They're meant to, you know, prevent city councilors, town councilors from doing things like harassing staff members or embezzling money or, you know, having things that look like conflicts of interest. But in recent years, we've seen them start going after fellow counselors for their political speech. And that's what happened to John here. You know, they did a big investigation. They found that he breached sections of the code of conduct related to ethical behavior, that related to, you know, discrimination and harassment and arranging your private affairs in a way that inspires public trust, all of which is irrelevant to the sign, because it was nothing to do with his actual job as a village councillor. It was just a sign on his property, and it's political speech, which is the most protected type of speech. So you would think that they would not be able to sanction him for his sign. And we're pretty confident that they violated the constitutional guarantee for free speech by sanctioning for him. They gave him a $500 fine, suspended him for 6 months, and demanded this forced apology to them and to the Indigenous peoples. And he refused to do that. So now the minister has launched an inquiry where one of the possibilities at the end of that is his removal. So just, you know, an official on town council being removed for his political speech.
And they haven't really flinched or blinked in this since he's, you know, secured legal representation through you and the CCF?
So we haven't heard anything from the town. They haven't flinched. What I can say is, the town very, very obviously messed up this investigation and this whole process in many ways. But the minister, in a sense, may have flinched because he issued an order in December that said, you know, you have 2 days to accept these sanctions, including the apology or resign. And John Robertson, he didn't do that at the time. You know, he was sort of looking for legal counsel and he was on vacation. So but he didn't do that at the time in any event. And the minister, I think, subsequently realized that there may have been some problems with this investigation and the sanctions, the way that things went about. So he rescinded that order and he issued a new order for an inquiry. So now he's going to sort of redo all of this investigation about whether John's sign somehow breaches this code of conduct, which I think it pretty clearly does not.
The thing that I find so incredibly, incredibly concerning about that, well, I find a lot of it concerning, but he's expressing a political opinion. He is an elected politician. Now, in this particular case, I don't think it's a position that Murray Harbor PEI necessarily has to deal with at the local level. It may conceivably, I don't know if it's near any Indigenous communities, but the fact of the matter is that when you have colleagues that are weaponizing this code of conduct process for people expressing political opinions, they're effectively overriding the democratic process. They're overriding the fact that constituents have the opportunity to vote politicians in or out based in part on their political beliefs.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's very crazy here that the minister could remove this person for his speech. I mean, that's up to the voters. And, you know, there's this idea that his speech was very controversial and unpopular. And that seems to be the case in public. You know, the town did get a lot of emails and things like that were from people that said he's a residential school denialist, which is absolutely not the case, or that he's you know, harming reconciliation. But there is also a silent majority out there that thinks, you know what, we were misled by the media in 2021, or at least by some parts of the media. And they're on John's team. You know, they're sending donations to the CCF. They're signing the petition on our website and they're emailing John to say, you know, we're with you. Just because you don't hear them publicly all that much doesn't mean that they're not out there. So we should, at the end of the day, we need to wait till the next election, and then it will be up to the voters if John runs whether to reelect him.
All right. Well, and he has to watch if he promotes himself on his sign. He may get slapped down again there. Josh DeHaas with the Canadian Constitution Foundation, also one of the hosts of Not Reserving Judgment. I think you have a new episode today, right? It's Wednesdays?
We do. And we're talking about this online harm stuff. So you can hear more of what we have to think about that and some of the rumors we've heard. So.
All right, perfect.
Check it out.
Lawyers peddling in rumors. That's very edgy in your world. All right, Josh, thanks very much. Really good to talk to you again.
Great. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.